because they're not closer to the people.
We got to stop it, brother. Let's get together and unify.
Trouble.
Radio Basics.
And there's always a message involved.
You're listening to Radio Basics, Monday night, 105.5. We got a big show. We got Stephanie Ross coming through to talk about the QP strike. And but right now we're going to go to a track, Toots Mytol and Derek Trucks.
We're back, CHRY, in the studio, Mr. Panos, myself, Dave.
Come on, everybody.
Hey, what day is it today, the 27th?
Yeah.
I don't like the 27th.
No?
Headlines. Tomorrow is going to be the first parole hearing in 15 years for Leonard Peltier.
Really?
Yeah. Mr. Peltier, famous member of AIM, American Indian Movement, throughout the 70s, was brought up on false charges of murder of two FBI agents, and despite the courts and everyone else pretty much conceding to the point that there is absolutely no evidence to throw him in jail for the murders, which he's serving two consecutive life sentences for, he remains locked in a cage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Canada actually. He was in Alberta.
Yeah.
And they
fled to Alberta.
You know, Canada's just like, nah, not here.
And this is amidst, I mean, USA consistently claims not to have any political prisoners within its boundaries.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you have Mumia. Mm-hmm. And with Obama in power, I mean, he needs to start pardoning some of these guys. And sisters, the Move 9, that's coming up.
Yeah,
well.
that's true, actually. You know, if Obama's capable of doing one thing, I know, like, people expect a lot from him, and I get there's not that much he can do, like, what with Congress and corporate lobbies, but there's one thing that Obama can do, it's pardon people like this, right? And Leonard Peltier is held up as the pinnacle of you know, false charges and political prisoners in the United States and beyond.
And I think Clinton even said he would release Peltier, and never did.
No. So, yeah, it's an interesting case, and when's the...
Tomorrow. Tomorrow. The hearing's tomorrow. So, hopefully, he's freed after 30 years.
That would be huge, and it'd be a big victory for, you know, all those people. AIM, and, like, anyone that, you know, protested against false imprisonment of that nature.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can get, you know, a person who's been a spokesman for the Peltier campaign, Ward Churchill.
Yeah, maybe we should contact him.
I think so. It's, you know, if you've never heard this guy and you hear him talk, it's just, he is just like a force when he speaks.
He is a force.
Unbelievable.
And he was reinstated recently as well, so.
Yeah, yeah.
After being fired
another victory.
Well, hopefully there's another one tomorrow.
Yeah, he was you know, a vocal critic of U.S. foreign policy, and he wrote an article, like a little manuscript called On the Justice of Roosting Chickens.
Awesome book, by the way.
Documenting, you know, the
egregious track record of American foreign policy over the last, what, 60, 70 years?
Yeah, and, you know, combating that myth of, like, why do they hate us? Why would they want to blow up the World Trade Centers? You know, documenting, like, just, I've never seen sourcing like this.
Just
like,
corpus amounts of...
Of cases, of stats, figures, and showing, like, what the U.S. has done all over the world. And, in fact, answering why they would hate him. And, you know, he's a very opinionated, polemical person when he writes and talks. And so what happened was they trumped up some charges of him, you know, plagiarizing some works. Or something, or maybe a false citation, and, you know, the academic world blew up, and they kicked him out of the state of Colorado, the University of Colorado campus, and just recently got put back in, so congratulations.
Yes, Ward.
Hopefully,
and
you know,
he's a close personal friend with Peltier, so
yeah.
I'm sure he's on the campaign trails trying to get him
exactly,
released as well.
Exactly, because he's, you know, he's been doing his own thing, his own case, and working with Leonard and countless others, so...
Well, I said it before, and I'll say it again. We at Radio Basics definitely support the liberation struggles of the indigenous peoples.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think much more even needs to be said. You know, we played a few shows ago the Kevin Annett interview documenting, you know, residential schools and stuff, and you know, hopefully we'll follow up on some of that stuff. So, plans. Well, hopefully tomorrow, you know, will be a victory.
Please.
Yeah,
please.
Yes, get this guy to jail, for the love of God. He's in, like, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas,
yeah,
or one of them.
He's at Marion first.
That's a brutal prison. That
Lord.
Is a bad one, yeah. And not that I know, but I've seen, you know...
I've seen pictures.
I've seen pictures and heard some stories, and so that's that. So, you know...
It's mentioned in rap songs, occasionally.
Yeah.
Let's go to commercial.
Yeah, we're going to go to commercial, play a track. We're going to come back with Stephanie Ross and talk about the QP strike. It's just been announced that, you know, they've reached a deal pending ratification on Wednesday. So hopefully, you know, Stephanie will be able to talk about this, if this is, in fact, a victory for workers or what the circumstances are. So, CHRY 105.5, Radio Basics.
Greetings, Massive. This is Steel. And you're tuning to CHRY 105.5 on your FM dial. Big radio station. Don't change it, you know. One love.
Then you turn and walk away, all for love, not even born yesterday. I see you on the streets and you just pass me by. You think I got no feelings, think I'm living high. But let me tell you, I could be on the TV, I could be in them magazines, but it's never enough when you felt the touch of an angel that's rocking your soul. When the chasing dollars is making me holler. I just don't know. I don't need a check, I need some respect, so people you know. And the war, and the babies crying, and the car, and the house, and the rings, and the things that don't mean nothing. Floating in outer space now. When the rain comes down, will you be around? When the sun comes up, will you always steal my fire?
Driving bus. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. We're back. So, it appears as if the 36-day civic worker strike has ended. Most media outlets confirm that a deal has been reached pending ratification vote on Wednesday. As of right now, the details of the deal have yet to be released, but QP leader Mark Ferguson has said that the city took the last concession off the table today, paving the way for the deal. If this is true, then it's a monumental victory for the union and working people alike. To talk more about QP, the strike, and much more is Stephanie Ross. Ross is a professor of labor studies at York University. She wrote her dissertation on issues affecting QP and has long been involved in the union. She joins us tonight on Radio Basic. Stephanie, are you with us?
I am.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Justin, for inviting me.
So, Stephanie, can you tell us anything about the so-called deal that was struck today between two sides?
I don't have any insider information besides what the public is hearing. And, of course, it's pretty typical for the details of a tentative agreement to be, you know, confidential until the workers themselves have a chance to look at it and vote on it. So what I understand is that a ratification vote will take place on Wednesday of this week, and that the city council itself, which is, of course, the employer, will vote on Friday. I'm not sure why they've opted to wait so long. I think that raises some interesting questions about the attitude of the city council towards their employees and perhaps also towards ensuring, you know, that city services get back on track as fast as possible. But, you know, who knows what they're thinking.
Yeah, I guess we'll just have to wait and see how they all develop. So, Stephanie, before we get into more recent things, can you give us a history of the union, formation and victories and things like that?
Sure. Well, you know, QP is a union that is a national union. It's Canada's largest union, in fact. It has, you know, over 500,000 members. It was established in 1963, and it was actually founded by two pre-existing public sector unions in Canada. One was called the National Union of Public Employees, which primarily represented municipal workers' unions like Locals 79 and 416, as well as the City of Windsor workers. They were part of that pre-existing union, and they kind of started forming their organizations through the First World War and the Second World War. And they had a real tradition of what you would call, I guess, local autonomy, where really they joined together primarily for kind of sharing of resources across locals, but they were in general quite grassroots oriented as locals. They really wanted to keep power, decision-making power at the local level, and really, in a lot of ways, quite suspicious of centralized, national union structures. So Local 79 and 416 kind of come out of that culture, a very long-standing culture of local autonomy. And in the 1950s, there was another national union called NUPC, a National Union of Public Service Employees, and they tended to represent hydro workers, local hydroelectric workers. And they had a very different kind of philosophy of unionism, much more professionalized. They tended to have a much more centralized approach to unionism. They really were kind of into a kind of unionism based on experts, like expert staff and so forth. And so the two pre-existing unions had very different philosophies, but one thing that they shared was the desire to create one big union of public sector workers in Canada. And that, you know, it was understood by both that public sector workers really needed unity in all of their sectors, and they really needed to stop competing with each other. So it took a long time for QP to actually come into existence. It was 7 years of negotiations between 1956 and 63, and even though, I mean, it has to be said that the merger was a really positive step forward for public sector workers. I mean, the enormous number of people who were organized in the first 10 years after QP who got access to unionism was incredible. But it was the case that QP, like any kind of union formed out of a merger, was based on a compromise between these two visions of unionism. And so, there was some kind of compromise to try and satisfy those groups within the union who really wanted to keep local autonomy enshrined in the basic structures of the union, as well as those people who really wanted a more centralized union, and that has led to a lot of internal contradictions in QP. It's the source of both a lot of important strengths of the union, as well as perhaps some limitations and contradictions. So, for instance, QP is actually, I'd say, looking at other unions, that, because of that importance placed on local membership control, it is a union that has a reputation for a greater local union democracy, where the membership have a lot more capacity to take initiative than in a lot of other unions, there's a lot more room for creativity and debate in the union, and also innovation in bargaining, because it's not a union where there's like a central leadership that determines bargaining for all QP locals. I mean, that happens at the local level, and there's over 2,000 locals. So that's really, I think, allowed for a lot of creativity and a lot of diversity in the union, and it's allowed QP, I think, to be a leader in perhaps not as a whole, but in certain important aspects of QP, a leader in very progressive social struggles, like, they were really at the leadership of getting same-sex benefits enshrined in collective agreements, fighting that at the Supreme Court level as well. They are quite noted for participating in coalitions around employment equity and pay equity. They are a very progressive union in many, many respects. And I think that the dynamic internal culture really fosters that. On the other hand, there is some difficulty in coordinating across locals and to be able to kind of act in a coordinated way, whether in bargaining or in political struggles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's some of those limitations have really shown themselves in the recent strikes, where you have locals engaging in various forms of defensive struggles, which are really important, but also experiencing a lot of isolation from other parts of the union as well as the rest of the labor movement. And I think that's partly a result of QP's structure and the legacies of of the compromises that were made in the early 60s to form the union.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, hopefully we can come back and talk about some of those limitations.
For sure.
And I also wanted to comment, like, one thing I noticed that demonstrates the progressiveness of QP was that they fought for, in libraries, more progressive literature on things like such as same-sex marriage or dealing with racism and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what's interesting about QP is that, you know, I mean, like a lot of public sector workers, but I think this is particularly true in QP, there's this, in a lot of locals, there isn't this real strong divide between workers' sense of their economic issues, like as something separate from the interests of the public that they serve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so there is a kind of a culture in QP of really thinking about the importance of the services that they provide and thinking about how their economic interests actually dovetail with the broader political interests of the public, like to access public services, to have services that are grounded in principles of equity, and I think that the example that you give is a good illustration of that they don't just see their role as sort of narrowly defending their members' economic interests, but that they have a role in society more generally to push for progressive change for the people that they serve.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. Okay, so if the strike is over, then what is your assessment of the strike? How did competing sides handle themselves, such as, you know, taxpayers or the mayor, media or the unions themselves?
Yeah. Well, I have to say that I think that you know, this strike and the strike in Windsor, the very similar strike of municipal city workers, which started in April and ended just last week, I think those are similar strikes, and they say similar things about the kind of the current state of affairs in labor relations and in the public sector, but more generally. And you know, I think that one of the things that both strikes say is that anti-worker forces in our cities and in our society more generally are more organized, and they have a great deal of capacity to frame the message and to mobilize what you might call the bystander public, right? The public that is maybe not directly a party to the conflict, but that obviously has an interest in its outcome. And that anti-worker forces, and I would say, unfortunately, that the city of Toronto's leadership, including some of the more reputedly pro-labor folks, you know, have to be seen as, you know, mobilizing anti-unionized worker sentiment. And unfortunately, I think they did so very effectively, and they have done so by playing on the fears of the public, the fears that the public has about their own economic insecurity, and turning that fear and resentment, perhaps that fear that they can't do anything about their own job insecurity or wage insecurity, and turning that resentment on public sector workers who are collectively acting to try and defend not only themselves but a sense of, like, the minimum standard that is a dignified standard in the local labor market, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the labor movement in Toronto, even though they have rallied around Local 79 and 416, I do think that a lengthy strategic discussion, a political discussion about why it was that pro-worker and pro-social justice forces were not really able to counter the anti-worker message, particularly at a time when only a few months ago, 6 months ago, there was a lot of anger against, I think public anger against, you know, those people in the sort of the elite level of the economy, you know, taking bonuses, you know, from out of the bailouts.
Yeah.
Even though you know, they had led those companies into ruin and destabilized the economy, you know, there was a lot of kind of anger and backlash against that, but that seems to have kind of dissipated. You know, those people who, you know, might have had a kind of, I don't know, beginnings of an understanding of the way that our economy is so class divided, mm-hmm. seem to have kind of totally forgotten that when it comes to the question of these particular strikes and what they say about, you know, who's going to pay the cost for the financial and economic crisis.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that has to do more with sort of the anti-worker forces having a monopoly over media discourse, or just a bad job from public relations on part of QP?
Well, I mean, obviously, it has to do with the first thing that you mentioned, for sure, that, you know, that that official media is certainly dominated by right-wing perspectives. Mm-hmm. But I think we can agree that there are a lot of alternative sources of information out there now. So it isn't that everybody's information is completely controlled by newspapers or official radio or television, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you look on Facebook and you look on the kind of the groups that have emerged, certainly there are support groups that emerged to support the various locals on strike. But there are a lot of groups that emerged as well to kind of, you know, articulate people's anti-union frustrations. And so, you know, and those are ways of distributing information too that are not completely controlled by official media. So there are questions to ask about that. Why is it that when people can access alternative information, they don't necessarily go to more progressive or left-wing sources to kind of understand and interpret what's going on around them? I mean, I think we could say something about the strategic choices of the unions. You know, I should say that, you know, we have to admire, you know, those people who believe that workers have a collective right to defend themselves, right? We have to admire their willingness of all of these locals to strike in the current context. It's an incredibly courageous and obviously risky thing to do. And it seems that in the case of Toronto, if it's true that all of the concessions have been removed from the table, you know, it's no doubt a victory. Mm-hmm. But I think both strikes raise important questions about how effective the union's ability to connect with the broader community that they serve have been, and how much they've prioritized that. You know, in the case of Windsor, which, you know, in a lot of ways was an even more kind of clearly principled strike, in that they were defending a post-retirement benefits package for new hires, people who had not even been hired by the city yet, but who city workers realized would be their future co-workers, would be, you know, the next generation of workers, and who would be working under a lower level of some job entitlement. You know, the workers on strike, they themselves were still going to get and are still going to get post-retirement benefits. Mm-hmm. So in a lot of ways, that strike was even more about directly using bargaining power to benefit future workers, mm-hmm. right? And yet, it was the case that the Windsor City workers had a very difficult time rallying explaining that message effectively to the community. The community really got stuck on the notion that you know, these workers were greedy, that they should be grateful just to have a job. And the message just didn't seem to penetrate that, in fact, what they were doing was, in a lot of ways, quite selfless, and is exactly what a lot of people who are often critical of the labor movement say that unions should do more of. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is a way in which some of that many unions, QP included, but many other unions, their relationship to the broader public and the way that they act on that and then foster that relationship has been perhaps not as much of a priority as it should be and has to be in the future. And when a crisis emerges, and we see how important that relationship is, you know, it's kind of in a way too late. And so I hope that a lot of sort of strategic reflection on those union community coalitions and relationships happens, and that people in the unions think carefully about like why it is that they weren't able to really mobilize the people that they often not only that they serve, but that they are in political coalition with.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, and you raise an interesting point. I want to go back to how how they flipped a lot of what they say in normal circumstances to provoke into something different to provoke, you know, taxpayer rage. They usually they promote individual initiative to you know, better yourself. We live in a very individualist society, and turn it into this. Well, we're all in this together, and you guys need to roll back. And and also they tell you to take pride in your job, but then you know. They shame people for having a good job with, you know, some sort of benefits and security for when they retire.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's only one thing to call it, which is, you know, that we're in a period of not only hypocrisy, I guess it's fair to say, but but lowering expectations, right? That that we are being always and in every day encouraged to lower our expectations as workers, as citizens, when it comes to things that make for a good quality of life for us, right? So I think what you say is really interesting. You know, when it comes to, you know, working hard and providing the employer with the value of your labor, then you should take pride in work, right? Because it's going to make you productive. But when it comes to protecting the quality of work for oneself and one's coworkers, that is somehow selfish, right? It's it as if to say protecting good quality jobs in the local economy doesn't have a broader positive impact, which all of the research on unionization rates shows that it does, right? The the higher the rate of unionization and the higher the capacity of unionized workers to sort of set the pace of wages and benefits and so forth, the better the spin-off effect is for the rest of the economy, because non-union employers, you know, don't want to risk unionization, right? So they have to kind of keep pace at least a little bit if they want to, you know, prevent people's discontent from turning into unionization, right? So, you know, in that sense, you're right. We are living in a topsy-turvy period when, you know, what's good for the goose is not good for the gander, right?
No, true. Okay, so let's talk about unions more generally. Many, like Judith Andrews, spokeswoman for Canadian Federation of Small Businesses, says unions aren't useful anymore and it's too antagonistic for working people than it is helpful. Is this so?
Well, in I guess it depends on who you whose interests are being thought of in this statement, right? Certainly for small business, it might be the case that you know, unions are a problem, right? But you know, in terms of understanding the value that unions have, it's the easiest thing to do is to look at the situation of workers who don't have unions. And in general, most people who don't have unions are much more at risk of having their basic employment standards rights violated. And the Toronto Workers Action Centre has documented very effectively the widespread violation of sort of basic employment standards like minimum wages, payment of vacation pay and stat holiday pay, or even to pay workers at all. I mean, the amount of businesses in Toronto who fail to pay their employees for work that they've done is really quite shocking. And, you know, as individuals, most workers, unless they have some extremely specialized skill, most workers have very little power as individuals with respect to their employers. And it's only with a union that people in a workplace are able to collectively express their interests and have some kind of bargaining power, have some kind of capacity to balance the unilateral will, the otherwise unilateral will of the employer to set the terms and conditions of work. You know, so a lot of people focus on the economic benefits of unions, which, you know, are generally quite real. You know, people refer to that as the union advantage. It's definitely true that people with unions have, you know, they make higher wages, they have more access to benefits, pensions, pay time off from work, all of that stuff. But I think more important, or at least as important, is the way that unions bring democracy to the workplace. Mm-hmm. That they provide a structure in which workers can actually have some say over their terms and conditions of work, and they prevent the employer from unilaterally controlling the workplace according to their own priorities.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a society that that puts such a priority on democracy, right? We're spreading democracy internationally, right?
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we would not think it is a priority to democratize the workplace is really quite, you know, it's quite crazy. And, you know, when you really dig into the statement that is made by the, you know, someone like the president of the Canadian Federation of Independent Business,
mm-hmm.
You know, they aren't interested in workplace democracy on the whole, because it means they have to share power in the workplace.
Right.
And that that interferes with their capacity to maximize profit on a very simple level. And so for workers, unions mean a better sharing of the economic product, but it also means, on a very fundamental level, the capacity to make the workplace more democratic. And frankly, I think that's something we all need more of.
Oh yeah, definitely. And it seems strange that she would attack Judith Andrews would attack workers and not attack like more larger businesses that like say your large big box stores, your Walmarts and Home Depots that come in and you know sort of through attrition just take out all the small businesses and
supplement
the workers, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I think that small business, you know, they're kind of in a middle position between, you know, workers who don't own anything, but they have to work for wages to survive, and really big capitalists, mm-hmm. like the finance capital or like the banks and insurance companies, and you know, big industries, right? Like, small business is really subject to the will of the financial institutions,
yeah.
To get credit and all of that. And so it is possible to imagine an alliance with workers, between workers and small businesses. I mean, who is it that patronizes small business?
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's
yeah.
the workers in the immediate community.
Mm-hmm.
And in that sense, there are shared interests. I guess the question is, what is the political force that is going to, you know, is out there on, you know, in the political terrain, trying to build an alliance, a political alliance against those large forms of economic and political power that really control quite a lot of our daily lives, and I think that is really, you know, absent in the present moment, and I think that also speaks to the way in which the labor movement, which historically has tried to produce those kinds of political forces, is really politically quite at sea right now, and doesn't really have a clear political strategy. It really is a strategy based on, you know, choosing the least bad of you know, the present political options, and really isn't trying to construct a real workers' alternative to both the present economy as well as the political forms of representation that we have, that I think a lot of people feel very, you know, dissatisfied with.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Stephanie, unfortunately, we're running out of time. So, in closing, is there any ideas that you have of ways of moving forward? You know, new avenues to pursue for unionism and building the working class?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, I mean, with respect to the unionized segment of the labor movement, I think that unions and union leaderships really need to think and prioritize building not just alliances with non-union workers, really thinking about how to organize non-union workers, whether they're employed or unemployed, and also to try and create new forms of working class organization that bring workers together outside of the workplace, right? That, you know, it may be in the present moment that there are a lot of workplaces where, you know, strategic gains can't be made because of the broader economic weakness, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the moment that we're presented with now is that we need to actually build I think, a new working class movement that goes beyond just representing workers in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And that also starts to put a more deep criticism, set of criticisms about capitalism back on the table.
Yeah.
And that to really identify who's on our side and who is not on our side. Mm-hmm. Who is it that is using economic and political power to the detriment of the majority, which I think is capital. And I think, you know, thinking about how to unite workers across their divisions, which I think are really, you know, emerged during these strikes,
mm-hmm.
And taking the time to try and innovate around new kinds of workers' organizations is going to be a necessary step forward to be able to put a more critical ideological perspective on the agenda as well.
Mm-hmm, no, definitely. And even just going back to, you know, after the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
It wasn't for a couple of years after that, you know, people started to mobilize, started thinking of new ways, moving beyond like old trade unions into more like industrial unions and
yeah.
And building themselves like that. So
absolutely. And I think that the danger is real if we don't do this. I mean, we are in a time of, you know, pretty serious reaction.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that the risks of not developing new types of workers' organizations are very serious. And so I really hope that the difficulties of fighting these strikes are appreciated by various in the labor movement, and that a new way forward, a new politics for workers starts to emerge.
Absolutely, yeah. And then on that note, I think we have to go. But Stephanie, we thank you very much from Radio Basics, and it's been
my pleasure. Anytime.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie.
Take care.
Okay, that was Stephanie Ross, professor of labor studies at York University. We're going to go to commercial and come back with Radio Basics.
Hi, this is Hilton Ruiz. You're listening to CHRY 105.5 FM. El sabor latino, la música buena.
CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics. You guys have gotten your daily dose of Toots and the Mitals. That was Celia.
Them.
Yeah, two
awesome
songs.
Song.
Great artist.
Amazing.
Yeah, so
He was recently inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think, too.
Really? Rightfully so, too. Oh,
jeez.
I mean, if you guys want a good album, go and get Toots' Greatest Hits. It's
It's
the party CD, for sure.
The best.
Okay, so, yeah, we spoke with Stephanie Ross tonight about recent developments in QP, and, if Mark Ferguson is correct and the concessions were taken off the table, that is a monumental victory for workers. And
huge.
And, you know, hopefully, as Stephanie said, they can, you know, rethink strategy, criticism, self-criticism, and, you know, look at ways to move forward. So
and perhaps look at some of their supporting views, especially with regard to Palestine and indigenous issues that they may have been lacking on over the last little while.
Well, it's like, Greg Albo said, they're not, they bring a diverse range of people together, and, you know, hopefully they can, link up with more progressive struggles, which they need to. They need to, you know, in order to build a bigger movement, not get hammered by, small businesses and who's, targeting is completely backwards. Mm-hmm. Like, why target your customer base?
Yep.
When you're not, looking at the bigger corporations.
Like, I mean, with that being said, if it is the case, it's a huge victory.
Yeah.
Amidst the sort of privatization and commercialization of municipal workers, I mean, it's huge.
And it's interesting that, I don't understand why David Miller didn't, point the finger at the provincial and federal governments who have been, completely silent on this about downloading costs onto cities. Like, I don't doubt it that, Toronto is lacking funds in areas. Like, I mean, the unemployment's up. Homeless has, gone way up since the Common Sense Revolution. And, David Miller was silent. Dalton McGuinty was silent. I think even, the federal finance minister was in Toronto. Just recently down at the harbourfront, and no word there about anything. So it's interesting. And Stephanie raised a good point too about how, 6 months ago everybody was furious about bailouts and, the Canadian pension plan. They got, $1 million bonuses in the wake of losing billions of dollars in workers' pensions. And now they've flipped it. So maybe it wasn't, it was a conscious effort, not something that's just incidental, that they, turn workers on workers instead of, workers against the class of capitalists in society. So,
Anytime they sort of, we can stop the continual attack on workers and workers' rights. Mm-hmm. I mean, workers have fought a lot for a lot of the concessions that we have.
Right.
And they continuously try to take those away, and every time we stop them, especially with something this big.
Yeah,
it's very good.
Yeah, it is really good, and so hopefully the developments there will be positive.
I can unload some of my garbage.
Oh yeah, I'm not affected by it, but I actually had to go and pick up my grandpa's garbage, dispose of it illegally, bring it to York Region, and pretend it's my own. That being said, so I guess we'll go out with a song.
What kind of song?
Or we could go out with actually a short little interview of Michael Leibowitz. I think we'll
have time for this. It?
Yeah, it's a couple minutes long. Vince usually takes a little bit of time coming in.
Vince,
his blues music,
baggy pants, and
yeah. So thanks for tuning in. CHRY 105.5 Radio Basics.
David Chin.
See you next Monday. Radio Basics.
While shelves.com medicine, people are sick. And while too many rooms to count are left vacant, people are homeless. Karl Marx spent his life trying to understand capitalism. He went to great lengths to spell out the contradiction between the needs of capital and the needs of human beings. Michael Leibowitz is a Marxist economist. He is also Professor Emeritus of Economics at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, British Columbia. His book, Marx's Political Economy of the Working Class, is being re-released this June. I spoke with Michael about Marx's understanding of capital's needs versus human needs. I began by asking Michael about Marx's overall aim when he envisioned a good society. Here's his response.
The basic story that Marx, will tell in Capital is, it's about what the nature of capital is and how this power over people know, is really the workers' own power. It's their own power turned against them. And for Marx, it's not an accident that happens, because it's the precise result of the nature of capitalist social relations, of capitalist relations of production. You know, and capitalist relations of production for Marx are based on the fact that there are two classes. There is the capitalist whose goal is wealth. Their goal is more value, increasing the value, their value. The goal is profits. That's what dominates their every move. And on the other hand, you have workers, people who have no means of production, for themselves, who, in order to survive, must sell their ability to work to the capitalist. They must sell a property. They sell the one thing that they do have, which is a property right, the right to use their ability to perform labor to the capitalist for a given time period. And for Marx, if you want to understand capitalism, you have to understand that the nature of that relationship and then the dynamics that flow logically, you know, from that relationship. And the dynamic is that the capitalist, for example, only buys labor power, the ability to perform labor from the worker, if that is going to ensure that he can make profits, if he can get additional value, if he can get surplus value. So we start from, you know, Marx's description of capitalism is describing us in a market economy, in which workers are selling something and capitalists are selling things, but you know, it's not any market, you know, economy. The unique characteristic of capitalist relations for Marx is that the worker sells labor power to the capitalist, and the capitalist is oriented toward profit. And everything flows out of that. After that transaction, you know, when the worker has surrendered this property right to the capitalist in order to get money to buy the things that she needs, you know, on a regular daily basis, then certain characteristics flow necessarily from that. They flow within the whole process of production, within the sphere of production. And one thing that flows immediately from this sale of labor power to the capitalist is that the worker works under the direction, control, and supervision of the capitalist. The capitalist has purchased that right, you know, to purchase the right to supervise and direct the worker. And then the other key characteristic of this, you know, transaction which has occurred within, you know, the marketplace, this particular unique transaction, is that because she has sold her ability to perform labor to the capitalist, because the capitalist is the owner of that ability to perform labor, that, in fact, the capitalist is the owner of all the products produced by the worker. The worker has no property rights in the products produced. And that, for example, you can see the real contrast between a situation in, let's say, a cooperative, or, you know, in which workers have property rights in the property, in the products they produce. But in the capitalist relation, where the worker has sold labor power, only the capitalist has those property rights. And that's then a key characteristic, because insofar as the capitalist is the beneficiary of everything that happens within the workplace, the capitalist uses his control within the workplace in order to attempt to get more and more surplus value, more and more, you know, profits from the exploitation of the worker. He does this by attempting to expand the amount of labor performed by the worker, by increasing the workday or by intensifying the workday. And so you get that is a way in which, you know, capital tries to increase the amount of surplus value. He tries to drive down wages and does anything possible to drive down wages or to increase the workday, separating workers, finding ways to divide them, and to prevent them from allying in any way. Because one of the things that, you know, it's not fully developed in Marx's Capital, because he intended to talk about this elsewhere and did talk about this in many of his political writings, is that workers, in fact, you know, combine to struggle against capital's tendency to increase the rate of exploitation, to increase the workday, to reduce wages, and they do this by forming trade unions and by organizing, by reducing the separation corporations among themselves, and so they struggle against the workday. They struggle against intensification of the workday, and that's, you know, that's that struggle of workers to reduce the workday is, in fact, the source of May Day itself, which was centered on the struggle for the 8-hour day, the struggle of workers to reduce the workday. So that's, you know, capital tries to, you know, to increase the rate of exploitation, drive down wages, increase the workday. Workers struggle against that. So you have, you know, very clearly characteristic of capitalism within the workplace is class struggle happening there, because each side, the capitalists and workers, have their own needs, have their own and have their own ways of struggling for this.
Siècle, l'homme invisible dès l'Ixon existe. Le préjudice demeure, persiste et puis signe. La résistance n'est plus dès qu'on s'y résigne. Et l'amnésie collective s'installe tranquille. La haine dans ce monde est basée sur des faits vécus. L'histoire se répète chaque fois qu'on dit jamais plus. Les cœurs s'assèchent comme un désert où il n'a jamais plu. Où les vautours rapacent qui étaient restés à l'affût. Il y a ceux qui ne connaîtront jamais l'aube de la fin. Pour d'autres, la fin du monde arrive chaque matin. Leur quotidien est aigre, doux comme le sucre de la canne. Et la misère dans la main maigre qui la coupe d'une hache. Ainsi va la vie qui va, ce n'est pas d'elle qu'on se cache. On prend notre place sur la scène et pas dans les coulisses. Même si on se dirige tout droit vers le précipice, à chaque jour on le lit sur la page frontispice.